Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. So, Julio Torres is an actor, a writer, and a comedian. And he's one of the funniest comedians I've had on the show. The LA Times recently called him defiantly unique. I think that's a pretty fair description. He doesn't have the typical background you see from people in entertainment. He grew up in El Salvador. He spent his entire childhood there, and he thought he'd end up as an architect, like his mother. But even in Salvador, he grew up on TV shows from the United States, and ultimately he decided that's what he wanted to do. It was classic stuff like The Simpsons and I Dream of Jeannie, but his one true love was the late 90s legal comedy drama series, Ally McBeal.
I loved Ally McBeal as a little boy. I just Lucy Liu's character in Ally McBeal was, I thought, the funniest thing. And of course, Calista Flockhart and everyone in it. But I loved Ally McBeal. I mean, it's just a very tender form of imperialism, really, that as a kid, you're consuming these, you're lovingly consuming these American products.
It's Bullseye. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Julio Torres. Julio was born in El Salvador. He came to the United States to pursue a life in comedy. His first big gig was writing for Saturday Night Live. Maybe you've heard of it. His sketches on the show are, well, they're a little different than the usual SNL stuff. It's not like topical material about politics or pop culture. It's dreamy and magical and almost wistful. Here's a good example. When Ryan Gosling hosted SNL back in 2017, Julio wrote this sketch about a man who is haunted by the font used in the logo of the film Avatar.
Avatar, the movie from like 9 years ago?
Yeah, he just highlighted Avatar, he clicked the drop-down menu, and then he just randomly selected papyrus, like a thoughtless child just wandering by a garden, just yanking leaves along the way.
And so now you're worried about the sequels that are coming out?
They're making more?
Yes, I think I heard that one.
So they changed the artwork. They fixed it.
It looks similar.
Julio's also one of the creators of Los Espookies. It's a show on HBO about a group of friends who turn their love of horror films into a business. They provide events and, I don't know, happenings for people who want to be scared. It's like the gig economy, but for spooky stuff. It is absolutely brilliant. Julio recently released his first comedy special on HBO. It's not what you would expect from an HBO comedy special. The premise is Julio talking about his favorite shapes. It's kind of surreal to watch. He shares his favorite shapes with the audience. These shapes are on display on a custom conveyor belt, sort of like the one in a sushi restaurant. There is a lot of glitter, and he imagines lives for these shapes, objects, really, that you'd never expect. But really, instead of learning about these shapes, we are learning about Julio. In this clip, he describes the journey that led him to discovering his favorite color.
It's a pyramid second, but first, it is one of my favorite kinds of shapes, which is clear with a little animal trapped inside of it. As I was preparing this show, and I was deciding which shapes were going to go in which order, and I was weighing out the pros and cons of all of them, thinking which one of them were stars, which ones were more supporting. And as I was just deciding all of that, I thought, oh, I'm sorry, is this one of the many good jobs that I'm stealing from hardworking Americans? Because, look, I'm just doing it because no one else was doing it and it needed to be done.
Julio, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
I'm so happy to be in the show.
Did you aspire to be a comedian when you were a kid in El Salvador?
No. No, I did not. I thought I was going to and wanted to be an architect as a child.
Why did you think and want to be an architect? What was the appeal?
My mother's an architect, and I've always just wanted to decide the way that things looked was something that I really liked as a kid. I would dream up these like dollhouses, and my mom would make them with cardboard and an X-Acto knife. And I just love the idea of creating and dreaming up worlds, for lack of a more specific term. I mean, I was writing little stories in as much as I was playing, creating little dramas within those houses within those little cardboard houses. But it wasn't until way later that I sort of stubbornly decided that that was going to be my path, writing and writing funny things. Before then, it was purely visual.
What was the comedy that you saw as a kid? Were you watching American comedy or Salvadoran comedy? Were Cantinflas movies?
Or what movies?
Cantinflas.
Oh, Cantinflas. I was familiar with Cantinflas, but I was not consuming. I don't think many kids my age were consuming Cantinflas. But, I mean, there were successors of Cantinflas that I was also not consuming a lot of. Inevitably, as a kid abroad, you end up consuming so much American media. I loved The Simpsons at an age where I was probably too young to understand most of it, as are so many of The Simpsons fans, I think. So many of those episodes really stayed with me. For some reason, I say some reason not because the show is not excellent, but because I was so young, but I loved Ally McBeal as a little boy. I just Lucy Liu's character in Ally McBeal was, I thought, the funniest thing. And of course, Calista Flockhart and everyone in it. But I loved Ally McBeal. Also, just like older shows. Like I loved I Dream of Jeannie. The inside of her genie bottle was something that I was always hoping I would get to see in any given episode. And also just cartoons, a lot of cartoons that were American cartoons. And it's just a very tender form of imperialism, really, that as a kid, you're consuming these, you're lovingly consuming these American products.
One of my most vivid memories of my childhood was being in southern Mexico, in Chiapas, when I was 9-ish. Mm-hmm. I think I was about 9 with my mom.
Yeah.
And I had made this friend, and my Spanish was very bad, and he didn't speak any English. So it was mostly us chasing lizards. Mm-hmm. And one day he knocked on our door, and he just was wide-eyed, and he looked at my mom, and he said, "Miki y Goofy. Miki y Goofy." And we're like, "What's up? What's going on?" He's like, "Let's go." And we went, and there was a Coca-Cola Miki and Goofy show in town.
Uh-huh.
That we went to see. They talk about soft imperialism when Miki and Goofy
Coca-Cola
are
a Coca-Cola show starring Miki and Goofy. Well, that is something that I've been thinking a lot. I mean, just with the news and everything that's going on. A really twisted tragedy in seeing a lot of these detained kids wearing like Disney merchandise, wearing like a Mickey Mouse t-shirt.
Migrant kids.
Yes. Yeah. Because the U.S. produces, and its fingers extend all over the world. And no matter where you live, the U.S. is a part of your life. And you are informed that it is the place to be by the U.S. By portraying it as like the only form of life that you can see on TV. And then people are like, "Well, maybe if that's what if we went there?" And then suddenly it's like, not so fast. It only goes one way, which is the sad part about that Mickey and Goofy story, right? That kid can't just come here. It's not that easy.
When you were a kid, your parents were like middle class, upper middle class in El Salvador, from what I understand. Were they committed to living and staying in Salvador?
I mean, they live there. So I would say they are committed to living there in as much as they live there.
But I mean, what I'm asking is, you know, if you're highly educated, you have relative opportunity to leave, and there were reasons to leave, especially in the 80s.
Yeah.
In El Salvador.
No, they never as hard time as they have had, because everyone is having a hard time in El Salvador. My mom's an architect and she's very smart. My dad is a civil engineer and he's very smart, and they're very talented, very capable people, and yet finding jobs is very hard. Making a living is very hard. But no, they've never thought about, I don't think they've ever thought about picking up and leaving and coming to the States, because the hurdle of doing that legally is so much more daunting than the everyday hurdle of being there, I think, which is why my father was perplexed by me wanting to come here and make a life here, because in his eyes, correctly, I had chosen the most difficult place to choose that I was going to move to. It would have been a lot easier for me to go to Spain, for me to go to Mexico, for me to go pretty much anywhere than New York City.
But you always wanted to move to New York City.
I always wanted to move to New York City, yes.
Yes. Was that just because there was a lot of Friends on TV, or...?
A lot of friends. Oh, the TV show Friends?
Yeah.
I think that subconsciously, my brain was trained to see New York City as the center of the world. And I think I romanticized what New York City could be. But then also that was just became a reality, because it is in many ways the center of the world I want to be in. If you like Saturday Night Live, then you should probably be in New York City, you know? And it is... I think it is currently still the only place I want to be in permanently. So yeah, no, I'm stuck by it.
Why do you think that you wanted to leave? I mean, to leave your home country is a big deal.
Right.
Irrespective of, you know, visa issues, of which you've had, you know, your fair share.
Mm-hmm.
Just leaving one country and moving to another is a big deal. I was scared when I finished high school. I was scared to
go to college,
move to the East Coast to go to college. I'm like, I'll stick with California.
Yeah. I think that I could only be scared at the next step ahead of me. I think that if as a teenager, I had sat and really thought about the predicament of going from one visa to another visa, then I would have been daunted by it. But if you take it one step at a time and you think that your problem is currently just getting enough money for the application, for the college application, then it's a matter of taking it one step at a time, I think, which is how I pursued my comedy career as well. Just being like, well, I'm just going to do this open mic, and then I don't know what the next steps are. I just know that right now, this is what I'm going to do, which is a lot easier to do when you're younger, I guess.
Let's hear some more from my guest, Julio Torres's new comedy special, My Favorite Shapes. So he's talking about objects that come to him on a special conveyor belt in a kind of Miami Vice-colored Memphis group set.
Mm-hmm.
And in this clip, a horse figurine that's maybe like 10 inches tall comes up before him.
A fact about me is that I wholeheartedly believe in reincarnation, because I just know in my heart that I was the Trojan guard who saw the Trojan horse approach the gates and was like, let it in. Oh my God, it's a big, beautiful horse. Open the gates and let it in. No questions asked. I don't care. Like any of you would see a big, beautiful horse come to your apartment and you wouldn't let it in, no questions asked.
How did you get the job on Saturday Night Live?
There was a friend who was then a head writer, Rob Klein. He was very into what I was doing. I think he was keeping track of my work as a stand-up, and he asked... I mean, if you ask them, I don't know if their version is the same, but my version is that I think he was the one who brought me to the table. So I guest wrote there for 3 episodes, and then they asked me if I wanted to write there full-time.
Did you ever have to have a conversation with, like, an HR person or a line producer or something where you had to say, yes, I want to do this, but you have to deliver an, you know, a TV star level of lawyers to get my visa situation settled?
Lucky me, by the time I got there, those visa situations had been dealt with. I already had an artist visa by the time that I was hired for Saturday Night Live. And then the irony is that as soon as I was hired for Saturday Night Live, lawyers who I never even met swiftly got me a work visa specifically for Saturday Night Live, just because that's their company policy. And then I believe I also got one for Los Espookies with HBO. So then it's just one of those things that, like, it gets really hard, and then it's, like, easy without you even noticing it.
My stepmother got her original status in the U.S. in the mid-'80s in a Reagan amnesty. Mm-hmm. And when she married my dad, became a lawful permanent resident. Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of September 11th, mm-hmm. she became a citizen. And, you know, that had been an option available to her for some time by then, because she was married to a citizen. But I remember her saying to me that, like, I'm going to be frank with you. She's not nuts about the United States.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the end, she just became a citizen because, as she said, like, I'm just scared I'm going to steal something and get caught.
Uh-huh.
Which she doesn't go around because she's not a thief.
But I absolutely understand what she's saying. The stakes are so much higher. Little mistakes that Americans can make that, you know, are a ticket maybe, snowball into your livelihood when you're not from here. I was terrified of jaywalking. Not so much because of a car, but because, oh, is this going to be the thing that kicks me out? So yeah, I mean, I sympathize with her and what she's saying. It's a security thing.
I want to talk about this sketch that you wrote for Saturday Night Live called Wells for Boys.
Yeah.
I really think this is, you co-wrote.
Yes, with Jeremy Byler.
I really think that this is one of the best sketches that Saturday Night Live has ever put on television. And given that Saturday Night Live is almost certainly the best sketch comedy show that was ever put on television, mm-hmm. it's like serious business that I'm saying that. I mean it too. It's a commercial for a children's product that's called Wells for Boys. Let's take a listen.
With Fisher-Price playsets, some kids can be four-star chefs. Some kids can win the race. But some just long to be understood. Introducing Wells for Sensitive Little Boys from Fisher-Price. Wells for sensitive boys to wish upon, confide in, and reflect by. Some boys live unexamined lives, but this one's heart is full of questions. Just hear how much he loves the well. He'll enjoy running his little fingers around the edge of the well. On days when he's had too much, he'll lean on it and contemplate his reflection. Some kids like to play. Others just sort of wait for adulthood.
That was me, just waiting for adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like you decided to write your autobiography in the form of a parody television commercial.
Yeah. Sort of.
You know, there's all these specifics in this sketch that I like dream on while I'm driving my car or something here in Los Angeles. One of them is there's a companion toy that's a balcony for when he's ready to make an announcement.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is, like, the idea of it being a sensitive, like, just the idea of, like, naming and describing and seeing sensitive boyhood is a big deal, right? Like, you don't get that much of that. But it could also just be, like, you know, it could also just be the opposite of, you know, rough and tumble boyhood or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's a pretty straightforward premise. But to me, that insight of a sensitive boy being ready to make an announcement at some point is so powerful and beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, it's written from truth, which is why I think that it registers as true to people. And I think that we have seen the trope of sensitive boy a lot, but it's always pointing at it and mocking it. And by the trope of sensitive boy, I mean, like, the nerd, the loser, like, whatever sort of broad label you want to put on it. And I think a lot of comedy has been mocking the weird or the other, which, as someone who feels like both, doesn't really come naturally to me. So I'm proud of what we did with that sketch, because I think it shows that being on the side of the weird or the other can be funny. You don't have to mock it in order to be funny.
Are you nervous when, I mean, this was a taped sketch.
Yeah.
But they play it for the audience on the big screen there. You know, I imagine you must have at least thought when you were pitching it in the room, well, I'm proud of this. Like, I think this is actually good. It's got good specifics. It's got good jokes. These comedy people, two-thirds of whom were, well boys and 20% of whom were well girls,
mm-hmm.
are ready for this. But then, like, when it runs out for the dress rehearsal or when it runs out in front of that live audience, it must be nerve-wracking to know that this is not a sketch about, you know, Lana Del Rey.
When you say a sketch about Lana Del Rey, do you mean like a broad sketch?
Not I think just a broad sketch, but a sketch that's
not
like
a very broad premise, actually.
Yeah, that's true. I've picked probably too specific a celebrity. Let's say a sketch about Hobbs and Shaw. Let's say where that article that we found out that no one in those movies is allowed to lose to each other because it would make them look weak.
Right. Right.
No,
I know what you mean. I'll say this. I'm always very pleasantly surprised when what I am proud of resonates with other people. And I think the same is true of this special.
Something that would happen sometimes is that we had this dog who I was so on, and it was mutual. And this dog, this puppy at this time, would chew on some of my toys. And I'd come back and find them disfigured. Whenever that happened, my mother would rush to the store and find the exact same one. And then I would perform a little ritual that I, in my head, called the transference, where I would take the soul of my old friend and whoosh it away from its body and deposit it onto its new vessel. And then I'd be like, great, I can play again.
I go out there thinking, like, well, I know I like this. Let's see if other people do. And that has been true of every dress rehearsal and also my stand-up, too, because I feel like I operate the same way with the two of them. But also, I don't know how to do anything else, so so I will continue to do that.
I want to play another Saturday Night Live sketch that you worked on. And my guest, by the way, is the comedian, writer, and actor Julio Torres. And this was when Lin-Manuel Miranda hosted. And mm-hmm. It's another filmed piece where he is making a call home from the Iowa cornfields. And it has the... You know, it has the aesthetic quality of, if I may be permitted, the literally the single most straight white guy aesthetic reference of all time. It has the aesthetic qualities of Field of Dreams, but with a phone booth instead of a baseball field. And he's having this conversation with his mom on the phone.
Aprendí muchos American sayings, como hit the road, Jack, hold your horses. These immigrants are coming to steal our jobs, but not like you, though. You're different. Every kiss begins with K. Algo más. Todas las casas son carpeted. Everything in America is carpeted. Espero verte pronto, mamá. Buenas noches. See you later, alligator. Bendición.
What's amazing about the sketch to me is it has this magical quality to it that, like I said, reminded me of Field of Dreams, mm-hmm. right? Which is the ultimate hegemonic, magical realist American story, right? It's like all straight white guys also have a silent straight white dad who just wants to play catch with them. But it has that quality, and it applies them with an outsider's perspective on these things about American culture that we are used to being presented from an insider's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that it also has this, at its heart, is him relating to his mom what is essentially a romantic relationship between him and the high school quarterback.
Yeah. Which is a point, by the way, that when people talk about whenever that is rarely brought up to me, the queerness
really?
In the
I feel like it's so queer. Like that's what's so beautiful, and what's beautiful about it, what's remarkable about it to me, is that this character's voice is encompassing both this, you know, he's describing what you know. It would be easy, things that would be easy to see as grotesqueries, right? Like there's so many Walmarts or there's salads made of marshmallows. But describing them in a way that is reverential of what's beautiful and remarkable about them, including being reverential of what's beautiful and remarkable about, you know, the high school football team's quarterback.
Yeah.
From the perspective of a queer kid who, you know, may or may not understand his own queerness. That's not entirely clear, but,
I don't think they do, or at least I recall giving Alex Moffat, the very funny SNL cast member who plays the quarterback. He asked me like, are they together? Are they not together? And I believe the note I gave Alex was, this is something that he will look back on years from now and maybe understand. So let's make a sketch. And that sketch, which I think is so beautiful to look at, was directed by Dave McCary, who directed Wells for Boys and the special as well. My friend and collaborator.
Let's talk for a minute about your new HBO show, Los Espookies.
Mm-hmm.
You are kind of a pan-Latinx cast and set of creators. Did you find, Fred Armisen is half Venezuelan, if I remember correctly. I think a couple of the main actors are Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
You have a variety of different, you're Salvadoran, of course. You have a variety of different places in Latin America and Latin American and Latin American-American experiences. What was the thing when you started working with, I guess, Fred Armisen maybe was the person who started developing this show, that you found bound this group of people together?
I feel like the show is not attempting to be the definitive representation of any kinds of people. It's not a show that attempts to or is interested in educating the American audience of like what it's like to be Latino. That's not the show that it is. It's just a show that I think thrives in its own oddity. It's a show made by people who enjoy things that are eerie. And there is a particular kind of Latin American eerie that is explored in the show that I think bound the Mexican actors and the Mexican director and the Chilean crew and the Chilean actors. And I think that the show almost developed a language in itself that was learned and quickly shared by the people who worked on it. I recall earlier on our really incredible Mexican actors were like, can you help me access what this show is? Because it's, you know, like me or my character are not like immediately clear. And then sort of once you get into that wavelength and learn that it's not that I'm missing something, it's not that I'm misinterpreting something, is that this is something new that we're all learning together, then I think it became clear and fun to them.
We'll have more with Julio Torres in a minute. When we're back, Julio talks about why, even though he just created a show called Los Espookies, he actually does not like things that are spooky. Not what you would have guessed. Stay with us. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Squarespace. Squarespace allows small businesses to design and build their own websites using customizable layouts and features including e-commerce functionality and mobile editing. Squarespace also offers built-in search engine optimization to help you develop an online presence. Go to squarespace.com/NPR for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code NPR to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Take a deeper dive into the art, lives, and legacies of Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, and the women who played a vital role in inventing American popular music.
I'll be seeing you.
Watch videos, read essays, and hear the full Turning the Tables playlist at npr.org/turningthetables.
Listen, I'm a hotshot Hollywood movie producer. You have until I finish my glass of kombucha to pitch me your idea. Go.
All right, it's called Who Shot Ya? A movie podcast that isn't just a bunch of straight white dudes. I'm Iffy Whiteyway, the new host of the show and a certified BBN.
BBN?
Buff black nerd.
I'm Alonzo Duraldi, an elderly gay and legit film critic who wrote a book on Christmas movies.
I'm Drea Clark, a loud white lady from Minnesota.
Each week, we talk about a new movie in theaters and all the important issues going on in the film industry.
It's like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner meets Cruising.
And if it helps seal the deal, I can flex my muscles while we record each episode.
I'm sorry, this is a podcast? I'm a movie producer. How did you get in here?
Iffy, quick, start flexing.
Bicep, lats, chest. Who Shot Ya? Dropping every Friday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Julio Torres. You can catch him in his new comedy special, My Favorite Shapes, on HBO. He's also one of the creators of Los Espookies, along with Fred Armisen and Ana Fabrega. You know, it's funny, like, when Fred Armisen started developing this show as something else, I read originally he was inspired by a trip to Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I went to Mexico City recently. I had never been before, and I was like, this is the best place I've ever been. This is just the effing greatest. I would also, if I were the kind of guy who created TV shows, be pumped to create a TV show about it. But it's not a show that ended up set in Mexico City. In fact, it didn't even end up set in a particular city at all. As you mentioned, you shoot it in Chile, but it really exists in this almost magical world. I mean, like, the closest you get to making it not live in a magical world of its own imagining is a part where Ana Fabrega's character, they ask her why she has that accent, and she says, and the explanation is like, oh, she went to Minnesota for a year and came back talking like that or something. And It must be fun that you're getting to write one of the first ever HBO shows that's primarily in Spanish, and that in so doing, you get to write something that is so weirdly specific about something that does not even actually exist. Like, it's not even like you're reproducing something weirdly specific. You're imagining something this weirdly specific.
Yeah, I mean, there's this sort of irony, right? That it's like, oh, a show gets to be made in Spanish by Latinx people. Oh, wait, the show is so obtuse that it might as well be a completely new language.
Yeah, there definitely could be a version of this show that's made in Esperanto, the international language.
Yeah, oh, I would love that.
But, like, honestly, the show, when I watched it, that it reminded me the most of, I mean, like, anytime you're watching something in Spanish on English language television, or in a normally English language movie theater, you're expecting, like, social realism. You know what I mean? You're expecting somebody mm-hmm. who's delivering a capital M message, because that's why the English speakers who program the thing
that is what allows a foreign work to have a seat at the table, right? To be an ambassador. They say, like, well, this is actually what's been going on with me. but this is a show that's unpreoccupied by that, I think, or approaches it differently.
The show it reminded me of was one of my favorite television shows of the last decade or so, Bored to Death, which mm-hmm. is, you know, set in a very particular Brooklyn-y world. But mostly it's just the thing that was always so distinctive about it to me is that Jonathan Ames, the creator of the show, who I like very much personally, has been a guest on this show, is a good and smart man, is a weirdo
mm-hmm.
who has his own way of seeing the world 100%. And it's amazing to me that they let him make a TV show that so reflected his own weird way of seeing the world. And it's so rare that you get to see anything on television that feels like it comes from someone's individual voice that is not an individual voice that you would expect. Like, this is an odd show. I love it.
Yeah, it is an odd show, yeah.
Do you actually yourself love spooky things?
No. I am very easily scared. I like the eerie. I like eccentric people. I like I'm attracted to the strange and the mysterious. So I think that is sort of that I approached quote-unquote spooky from that angle. And silly, because spooky things are silly, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's much more gentle and silly than you might expect from the premise of a gang of people gets together to start a company putting on spooky happenings.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a real gentleness to it that you don't expect from seeing a big exorcism scene.
Right. Which is such a tender scene.
let's hear a scene from Los Espookies. So most of it is in Spanish with subtitles. Some of it is in English with Spanish subtitles. So we'll play some of that. And one of the characters in the gang is portrayed by Ana Fabrega, and her name is Tati. And so she has been taking any job she can get, including a job breaking in other people's shoes for a while, working the second hand in a clock tower for a time, and at one point getting wrapped up in a pyramid scheme selling nutritional supplements. So in this clip, Ursula, who's Tati's sister, gets a phone call from the CEO of the supplement company.
Bueno?
Hi, I'm calling from Earbolite Collections. Is this Miss Ursula I'm speaking to?
Sí.
Well, good evening to you and your family. This is just a friendly reminder that you're out of time.
Where's my money? Do you know who the f*** you're talking to? I'm the Earbolite CEO, Mark Stevens,
and I personally handle collections. Chasing down people like you is what I live for. You have 5 days to come up with my money.
Please remain on the line for a brief survey about our call today. Mark's threats were A, concise and articulate,
B, a little vague and confusing.
That was a great John Early, one of the funniest dudes out there.
Yeah.
Man, that dude's funny.
He's brilliant.
That little giggle at the beginning really killed me.
Heaven.
How do you cast a show like this? I mean, a couple of cast members are people who made the show. So you've got those.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a couple of cast members who are actors who mostly work outside the United States in Spanish.
Yeah.
How do you find the people?
Well, in the case of, very quickly, in the case of the of all the English speaking roles, including John's, those are all friends. Or those are all buddies that were excited to be on the show, that we're lucky that they made the time to be in our show. But as for the actors who play Ronaldo and Ursula and like pretty much everyone else, some of the casting was done out of Mexico, where our director knew a lot of actors, so we were guided by him and our casting director, and that's how we came to know Bernardo, Cassandra, and Jose Pablo, who are in every episode. And then our guest actors, most of them are casted out of Chile. And it's just watching a lot of self-tapes, just watching a lot of auditions. And we've gotten so, so lucky to meet so many incredible actors who are just so, so funny.
Are you surprised that things have worked out for you personally in the way that they have lately?
I don't think so. I mean, first of all, I'm very conscious of that. I'm very conscious of, like, I'm just starting, building something. And I'm also very conscious of the fact that not everyone gets to be afforded the opportunities to start building something. But I think it's because I'm stubborn that I've always been like, well, yes, of course, that's what I was going for. So what next? What now? Which is kind of how I operate.
Well, I'm so glad for my own sake that you've gotten to do all these wonderful things so that I get to see them. I'm such an admirer of your work. I'm so grateful that you took this time to be on Bullseye. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Julio Torres, everybody. Do yourself a favor. Watch My Favorite Shapes on HBO. It is one of the most distinctive and remarkable comedy specials I've seen in a long time. And basically, I am completely in love with Los Espookies, so you've got to watch Los Espookies. It is really, really something special. He has also written a few of the best Saturday Night Live sketches of all time. All of us are lucky to share a planet here and now with Julio Torres. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye, produced at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where this week the lake at the park was refilled. Yeah, there's a giant water cannon that shoots water into the lake. It's great. Great. Every time it happens, it's a thrill. Anyway, show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He's away. Raghu Manavalan is filling in for him, wearing a floral hat today. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We get help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellow is Jordan Cowling. Jordan, it turns out, hates the movie The Godfather, listed by many as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, film ever made. She watched it for the first time recently and thought it was super boring. It was also her birthday this week, so happy birthday to Jordan. Our interstitial music is by DJW, also known as Dan Wally. Thanks to Dan. Don't know how he feels about The Godfather. Probably likes it. Most people do. Our theme song is Huddle Formation by the Go Team. Thanks to them and Memphis Industries, their record label, for letting us use it. And before you go, did you know that we've got 20 years of Bullseye in the can? Okay, not quite 20. It's like 18 or 19 years of Bullseye in the can. And almost all of it is up on the internet, so you can listen to, you want to listen to Brian Posehn and Steve Agee talk about the Sarah Silverman program? You can do that. They were great on that show, and they're sweet guys. You want to hear Ted Leo perform songs live in my apartment, when I used to record the show in my apartment? You can do that. You can find all our past stuff at our website, Maximum Fun. You can also find years worth on YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. We're at Bullseye on Twitter. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio shows have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.